Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. We have a study that we're going to talk about calcium is good against cancer in the colon. We have University of Montreal, exercise is a future anti-cancer therapy. And from Duke University, how poverty marks a gene, predicting depression. And also how bright artificial lighting causes havoc on your metabolism, especially after a meal, and more on health and healing. Then we're going to look at what happens when water in just one relatively small area of Africa is disappearing, and it is. How many people use that water? 30 million. What's being done about it? Nothing. And we're talking about an area that is relatively small. The people are a whole lot, 30 million is a lot of people, and you wouldn't know it. Well, we're going to let you know this is just one of the consequences of not understanding natural resources, what happens when we don't have enough, or we overuse it, or we overpopulate an area, we overdevelop an area. There's always a consequence. I'm going to have some short segments today, one from Professor Robert Reich on the laws that they're promoting, and they're really good at promoting these, including the right to work. So you would assume that that gives you a right to work, just the opposite. But that's going around the country now. And also, we're going to deal with this. There is a Vice Television interviewed Edward Snowden. Shane Smith went to Moscow, did an interview. From that interview, which is not that long, I'm going to ask a question that we'll ask you to call in after you hear what the issue is. It's a very important issue, and we'll deal with it. So those are some of the things we're dealing with today. Let's begin. There was what is called a meta-analysis, and that means multiple studies. And this was published in the World Journal of Gastroenterology. And they found that when they looked at all these randomized trials using calcium, it was preventative of colorectal cancer. So that's good. And it showed that during a 60-month follow-up period, it still was good. So this was with about 1,200 milligrams of elemental calcium per day versus a placebo. So for those of you taking your calcium, best to take it in the evening, by the way. Now, for those of you who've been exercising, you've been doing the right thing, according to the University of Montreal, because they're finding that it really helps prevent cancer. And, of course, if you exercised 4 or 5 days a week, that would be even better. And this was a Dr. Fred Said, a urologist-oncologist and a research university of Montreal. And they said he believes that physical exercise has a direct effect on cancer, as effective as drugs for treating people with prostate cancer, for example. Quote, typically patients with metastasis often become sedentary. It is thought that this affects cancer progression. And normally patients at this stage have a life expectancy of 2 to 3 years. We want to reduce mortality by at least 22%, which represents about 6 months of longer survival. This is the equivalent benefit of a new drug. And that's what they got. Now, I'll add this into that because I work a lot with terminal cases. And good news, two of them completely cancer-free after about a year of alternative programs. And I'll read you their letters on an upcoming program. A Dr. Otto Warburg is one of the most important physiologist scientists. He won the Nobel Prize. And he found that cancer does not thrive in a high oxygen medium. Now, that is different than what I've read, which is wrong. Oh, cancer can't grow in the presence of oxygen. That's not true. But it does not thrive. And therefore, people living at higher altitudes have historically had less cancer. What if you don't live at high altitude? What if you're not at 5,000 feet in Colorado or 7,000 feet in New Mexico up around Santa Fe? What then? You exercise. You get the same benefit. A sustained aerobic exercise for about an hour, 6 days a week, is tremendously beneficial for killing cancer cells. I mean, you're killing a lot of cancer cells when you exercise. Also, hyperbaric oxygen therapy is also good, but the average person's not going to be able to do that. It's too expensive, or they just don't have the availability of it. And outside of a hospital would never allow you to use their machinery for cancer because they haven't done the research on it. So go to a gym, get yourself a stationary bike, bike outside if you can, inside if you can't, a power walk. All these are great for cancer because it creates a lot of oxygen. The aerobic exercise of breathing deeply is anti-cancer, and that's what they found here. So think of all the millions of people, especially in America, over the last, let's say, 30 years, who've died using only orthodox therapy. And please keep in mind that over 98% of all cancer treatment is orthodox. Only a tiny amount of people seek alternative therapy, and that's after orthodox has failed them. So I see almost no one ever comes when they have cancer diagnosed and wants to start on an alternative program. They all go the orthodox route. And the orthodox community never takes credit for 500,000, half a million deaths a year using only their therapies. Now, just as a question, you would think that after 40 years of war on cancer, hundreds of billions of dollars spent, hundreds of thousands of people working in hospitals, foundational settings, research institutes, all on cancer only, that someone would say, you know, we have contributed to the death process of at least 15 million people. Chemotherapy is a known carcinogen. Radiation is a known carcinogen. And they don't always die of cancer. They will frequently, if you have, for example, chemotherapy, you can die of diarrhea. It can really disrupt your intestine and the microbiome in the intestine. People can't hold any nutrients in and dehydrate. It's happened lots. So wouldn't you then suggest you look at a different paradigm? Well, you should, and reasonable people would, but then what's going to happen to your research grants? Because you can live forever. An entire generation you can go through without ever having to cure or benefit a single person as long as you're on that feeding line of the peer review system. It's just one stupid game. I wrote the first definitive article published in a national magazine in American history on the politics of cancer. And then I would go on to write dozens more and do some documentaries on it. And did a piece in 60 Minutes and a separate piece which won an Emmy on 2020, exposing the fraud that is today our entire cancer establishment. And I mean our entire cancer establishment today, in my opinion, is one giant fraud. And what makes it a fraud? Because otherwise highly intelligent, extremely skilled technocrats, medical technocrats, have a more than reasonable expectation that they're not going to reverse a cancer or substantially improve the quality of life. To the contrary, more often than not, the quality of life will be diminished. So shouldn't they change? They should. Something as simple as getting in juices, known cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, broccoli sprouts, asparagus, kale, watercress. These things are known in the scientific literature, but that's not the literature they're reading. And then you start seeing how monotheistic, myopic, single-minded so many physicians and surgeons and scientists are, and they're not reading all the literature. They're reading only their literature, and their literature doesn't hold out any hope. Just more drugs, more money, more treatment, more money. Poverty marks a gene, according to Duke University. And this was published in Molecular Psychiatry. What this means is this. There's a long line of research linking poverty and depression. And it shows how our biology might underlie the depression experienced by high-risk adolescents whose families are socioeconomically disadvantaged, or they're poor. And the results are part of a growing body of work that shows that we have biological predictors that could guide individualized depression prevention strategies. But in lay language, put yourself in the shoes of an adolescent, and you're growing up in a home that maybe historically was fine. You weren't deprived of things. But now, because of someone losing a job, downsizing, not being able to pay the bills, stress of being underwater in the mortgage, having payday loans, which I believe should be banned. I believe every payday loan should be forgiven. And then the entire industry put out of business. In fact, I'll tell you what two things I know would work, absolutely know would work, but we're not going to do them. A, we should have in every community in the United States people who've been in business in that community for a number of years and therefore grounded and anchored in the community. They should be able to have a group of them, let's say four of them, look at applications for loans from people who would like to open up businesses or expanding existing businesses in their community, but they need money. This would be given by the federal government at zero interest and have at least 24 months before the first payment is made. That gives a business a chance not to be undercapitalized and not to feel that they are overwhelmed by servicing debt, because that's what causes a lot of problems. And then they have a chance to help that local community grow, the business to grow. But here's the catch. For every $1 million of loan, and it would be up to $5 million, they must employ two people at a living wage with health insurance. Now, if you did this nationally, realizing that right now the number one employers in America are not the governments, state and federal, local, not the Fortune 500 companies, not Silicon Valley. It is small business people. So if you give them an infusion to help them, then you could probably have between at least 2 to 3 million new businesses started, because we are not short of great ideas in this country. And you would reindustrialize, reestablish healthy local commerce. We're not talking about box stores. We're not talking about multi-gigantic corporations. We're talking about the type of businesses that anyone like myself who grew up in a small town was familiar with. That passes a dollar around the community 60 to 70 times. Right now, it's only about 7 times. When you order something and that goes to a major corporation, it stays there. But when you used to go to have dinner in a local diner, and then the people in the diner took your money, and then they would go to a movie, and the person that had the movie theater would go buy some shoes, it circulates around the community. And that's what we need. We need to re-employ people. We have 96 million people who could be employed. And how do you fund this? It's simple. It's really elementary. You have one flat tax, and you do not tax people's income. We do not need an income tax. We were thriving before the income tax. You have a corporate tax, and everyone has to pay the exact percentage. And let's make it very low. Right now, 35%. Let's make it affordable to everyone who has a business. Let's say it's 20%. But every corporation has to pay it. You cannot offshore money. You cannot offshore. In fact, you should make it against the law to offshore profits and other companies, tax havens. You abolish the IRS. You abolish the Federal Reserve. You let the Treasury print money at zero interest, so you no longer have that servicing of the national debt with interest of $700 billion a year. Now, what does that do? It gets you another $1.5 to $2 trillion in revenue that comes in. That, over a period of just a couple years, would completely de-ghettoize America and rejuvenate it. But mind you, you could have no deductions. So every company, everyone doing business would have to pay a small, fair tax. And yet people don't want to do that because the wealthy people and corporations know that as long as they can hire all these tax avoidance CPAs and lawyers, they don't have to pay any tax. And so the corporations making billions of dollars in profits pay zero tax. And that would make an enormous difference, huge difference. So you employ people, you get more income, and also put a tax on every single algorithm trade on Wall Street. Make it small, 2%. 2% on every algorithm trade made on Wall Street, on every trade made in Wall Street, you just brought in another $1 trillion. Well, now, gee whiz, you got that, and then you have universal health care, you eliminate all the insurance agencies, and the $1.2 trillion we're wasting on that each year, and the $200 billion on defensive medicine that's unnecessary, and then you allow people to have the best procedures of their choice at the least amount of cost, and you save another $1.5 trillion, and people get healthier. You see, it's not difficult to do, and it all is verifiable. It's just that who's going to give up the money when they're making it? And they're going to have politicians in place to protect their interests. So now you're a kid, and you're in a poor family, and you can't afford things, and you feel bad. That has a psychological effect upon most young people. And frequently they are excluded by other selfish people, their peers, when they can no longer keep up with the standard of living. They no longer have that disposable income. And so they're stigmatized. And frequently when people are stigmatized, they either withdraw within themselves, depression, low self-esteem, a sense of hopelessness, or they start to congregate around other people who are also like them. And that doesn't mean that they feel better about themselves. They just have the misery of company. And so now what you have people whose DNA, their actual structural DNA, is now being altered in a way that predisposes them to depression, and with depression, higher incidence of heart disease, suicidality, disease. You turn off the healing process when you're in a depressed state. And that's why so many people who are depressed also suffer from so many, a myriad of immune-related conditions, because the body's immune system is best when you're happy. I always say to people, you can't be healthy if you're not happy. I stick by that. Temporarily, for a period of time, you can interfere in the symptoms, but to really get a person thriving, they have to be happy with themselves and with life, irrespective of the circumstance they find themselves in. Something to share, something to think about. And this study actually is now proving it, because it's showing that adolescents growing up in households with lower socioeconomic status were shown to accumulate greater quantities of a chemical tag on a depression-linked gene over the course of 2 years. And these epigenetic tags work by altering the activity of genes. And the more chemical tags an individual had near a gene called SLC6A4, the more responsive was their body to the brain coordinating this reaction, and fear, insecurity, uncertainty, all this ends up marking in the brain, and you can see it with MRI scans. And so participants with a more active amygdala were more likely to later report symptoms of depression. Quote from the study from Duke University, "This is some of the first research to demonstrating that low socioeconomic status can lead to changes in the way genes are expressed, and it maps us out through brain development to the future experience of depression symptoms." So we should be doing an awful lot more to help people who are disadvantaged at the psychological level, at the behavioral level. There's so many things we could do. We could, for example, we could go into ghettoized areas, low economic areas. We could take over city blocks and build community theater, community workshops, trade workshops where people can learn trades. So even if they're living in a poor environment, even if they don't have money each day, they could learn something. They can be in an environment that would inspire them. They could have community gardens. So the fact that a person is financially poor doesn't mean they have to be poor in the social resources to help them until they get to the next step in their life. And finally, from our health venue today, this is an interesting study. It's about electromagnetic frequencies from the sun and the earth, and these frequencies are considered essential to all life. That's why we feel so good being outside in the sun. Life itself synchronizes and harmonizes with these frequencies. But what happens when these frequencies are disrupted by our modern technology? Now, you've heard me many times say that you should not be using a cell phone up to your head. You shouldn't have at night. Your computer should be turned off, meaning no electricity to it. You should not be within at least 8 feet of any electromagnetic appliance. And because all this is going to impact the body. Well, most scientists agree that artificial lighting and modern technology available across the world disrupts our natural environment and affects our metabolism. And according to this study out of Northwestern University, bright light exposure increased insulin resistance compared to dim light. And so with the growing use of energy-saving lamps and the development of new lighting technologies comes a long-term concern that some people who have conditions that react to light might be negatively affected by this shift. Artificial light is composed of visible light as well as some ultraviolet, or UV, and infrared, IR, radiations. And there is a consideration that the emission levels of some lamps could be harmful for the brain and the eyes and the skin. And artificial light can also disrupt the human body clock and the hormonal system, and this can cause health problems. And the ultraviolet and the blue components of light have the greatest potential to cause harm. And the effect of light on cells depends upon the radiation and its wavelength and the type of cell and the chromophore and the chemical reaction involved. So the best light is natural lighting. To be able to have a window that you can have to get light in, that would be the best. So stay away from a lot of the artificial lighting because it can play havoc with your metabolism. And what if your metabolism already is in problem? Then you got more of it coming. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? This is from Charles Pierce from Esquire. What happens when water for 30 million people disappears? Believe it or not, there are actual concerns in the world that do not depend upon 1,000 people in Iowa called at random. And think of the trustworthiness of a guy who gets policy advice from Alec Jones. This is, for example, the Lake Chad Basin in Africa, which is probably where our next humanitarian disaster is about to happen. Now, what you have is you have a lot of millions of people live in the region, which also happens to be where Boko Haram has been on a rampage, slaughtering people and burning people out of their homes. But you have there a major crisis. Why? Because you have a lake, and that lake is drying up, and that lake impacts a lot of people. Nigeria, Niger, that's the area. And so what's being done about it? How about nothing? And you have Cameroon, also Chad. Nothing is being done to help the people there. So what I'm suggesting is that in Africa, India, and many other places in the world, the natural resources that people have depended upon for long periods of time are no longer reliable. As a result, even in the United States, Lake Mead is at its lowest level in its history since the dam was built. And so that serves 30 million people in the United States. So we got people in Arizona, in Nevada, in California going to be impacted. What's being done about it? How about nothing? So what we have is we have major environmental problems where soil is drying out, temperatures are so hot. And by the way, when I say that a town in India had the hottest day, the ambient air also has to be included with the ground heat, and it feels then about like 170 degrees. Try to exist in that. See how that goes for you. Well, of course, that's going to destroy fruit trees, it's going to destroy seeds in the ground, so then you don't have anything to eat. And that's coming more and more around the United States. Exceptionally hot days is adversely affecting agriculture. So now's when you should be planning for yourself where are the most sustainable places to live. I'll be doing a program on the most sustainable places in the near future. But now we're going to, so I just want to bring that to your attention. Not that we have solutions today, but I would like for the people to know that you have over 200 million people in Africa alone who are resource limited, and a lot of them don't have enough food or clean water. You also have this in India. So we have over a billion people who are adversely affected today, and we just don't make it an important issue. And without the political will to make this an issue, we're not going to have results that are going to benefit these people. As a result, millions of people in the near future will be suffering and many dying because we didn't make it important. Now we're going to Paris, France. We're standing by is Charles Glass. We're going to talk about putting a different light on the understanding about the catastrophe in Syria. Charles is an American-British journalist and broadcaster who's highly respected internationally for his investigative reporting from the Middle East. And for a decade, starting in 1983, he was ABC's chief Middle East correspondent, and he worked with CNN and ABC as well. His articles appear in The Guardian, Time, Telegraph, Harper's, Newsweek. And in 1987, while reporting from Lebanon, Charles was kidnapped and held hostage by Shia militias for 2 months. He broke the story of Saddam Hussein's possession of biological weapons a year later, and his covert reporting in East Timor in 1992 resulted in the U.S. Senate suspending military aid to Indonesia. And he's reported from Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq on many occasions. He's the author of 7 books, his most recent being a concise history and background into the Syrian crisis entitled Syria Burning, a short history of a catastrophe. His website is charlesglass.net. Nice to have you with us today, Charles.
Thank you very much.
At this moment, Syria is perhaps one of the most dire regions on the planet. Upwards of 8 million people have been displaced from their homes. Hundreds of thousands have been killed. Refugees abound and creating havoc in other countries, including Europe. And although ruled by a dictatorial family for over 40 years, Syria nevertheless was a secular nation that honored plurality and was far more stable and peaceful from internal sectarian and religious discord before Sunni fundamentalists and the United States and its allies intervened. Yet we're never told that story. We're only told it was all bad, Assad has to go, just as Gaddafi had to go in Libya. And when you take a look today at Libya, where we had Hillary Clinton bragging as part of her campaign of, you know, we came, we saw, he died, and she was laughing about it. I wonder if she's actually looked at the video of how he died, and or how any of these people died, and what these countries look like and how they function today versus before our interventions. Also, the mainstream media pays no attention to the role of United States and its allies in the intervention of these countries. We're made to believe that it was all spontaneous uprising with the people as part of the Arab Spring, wanting to overcome the dictatorial family and develop independence. And we only came in later, much later, to observe this or to help those who were seeking peace, democracy, and freedom. And that's the official story. We're told nothing else. So we are never told the complexities of Syrian society, and it's more difficult for the average person to fully comprehend what's going on in Syria because they're not given all the information. Our mainstream reporting lacks any clear understanding of Syria's long-term history of the crisis they faced. There was the suppression by the Ottoman Turks. There were the blockades and internal wars created by the British and the French, and periods of drought and famine during the last century, killing millions. And I'm sure the Syrians themselves don't fully understand all that has happened because of so many factions meddling in the battlefield, including ISIS and other militant organizations, the Turks, the Kurds in the north, U.S., Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel, and others supporting the ouster of Assad, Iran supporting Assad, Russia supporting Assad. So it can be very confusing. So would you please summarize the difference in the quality of life before and after the current war and conflict, and possibly give us a history lesson that puts Syria in a more enlightened frame of mind for us. The forum is yours.
Well, summarizing is no easy trick because this has been going on a long time, and as you just said, so many people are involved both internally and externally that it's difficult to give a short précis of what's going on. But to take your point about American involvement in Syria, this goes back a long way. Syria, after the French departure in 1946, had a parliamentary democracy. In 1949, that democracy was overthrown in a military coup staged by the CIA, who put the military chief of staff, General Husni Zaim, in charge because it wanted Syria to get better terms for an oil pipeline from Saudi Arabia through Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Husni Zaim signed that agreement, which the parliament had been debating, trying to get better terms from the oil company. But Zaim put it in within days of his coup d'etat, taking over the country. After that, Syria suffered a series of military coups, almost one every other year, between 1949 and 1970. Some of them backed by the CIA, some of them backed by the Russians, some of them simply internal factions trying to get outside support for their takeovers, their putches, basically. In 1970, the last coup took place, and that was the coup of Hafez al-Assad, who was the Minister of Defense and was an Alawite, which is a small quasi-Shiite minority who live in the coastal region in northwest Syria, who traditionally, to survive under the Sunni Ottomans, had been very conspiratorial anyway. And he took power, and that was the last coup. And he then reinforced his regime, and he, over the years, made it inoculated against future coup attempts, because he knew exactly how coups were staged, because he had observed all of those coups in the 50s and 60s. When he died, he left his son in place, and his son continued a policy of keeping the regime solid and secure. And it could not be overthrown from the inside because the security services all spied on one another, and the population was spied on a great deal as well. It was a ruthless tyranny, nothing as ruthless as, say, Saddam Hussein next door in Iraq, but it was a very thorough tyranny, and many people were dissatisfied with it. They were also dissatisfied with corruption. Many of Bashar al-Assad's relatives have made a lot of money out of the state. His cousin has the monopoly on the mobile phone business, for example, and makes millions every year on that. The popular unrest began to manifest itself in March 2011 in a village called Dara, which is on the border with Jordan, when some children wrote some graffiti against the regime, and they were arrested, and some of them were tortured. and the regime reacted to popular demonstration against that arrest of the children with violence, and that was really the beginning of this whole unraveling of the Syrian state. The demonstrators originally in Daraa, and these demonstrations, by the way, spread to other cities, to Damascus, to Homs, to Hama, and in those other cities, they were fired upon by the police and security forces. And some of the people who were against Assad decided that it would be better to shoot back and to take up arms. They were encouraged in this by Western intelligence services, by Saudi Arabia, by Qatar, and by Turkey. And the Turks enabled through the Turkish border vast numbers of jihadis to come and swamp the Syrian revolution and basically to co-opt it, which is what we've seen now. So it has become a contest between a regime which was brutal but tolerated all religious differences. No one was persecuted in Syria because he was a Shiite or because he was a Christian or because he was an Armenian. So that side of the system was, you could say, positive, and most people in Syria favored that. On the other hand, on the other side, you have the jihadis, mainly ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra and Jaish al-Sham, who want to impose another form of dictatorship, probably much more ruthless, and as we've seen in the areas where they govern, much more brutal than the Assad regime itself. So you have a choice, if you're a Syrian, between a dictatorship you knew, which was at least secular and which didn't persecute you for your religious beliefs, and a much more thoroughgoing dictatorship of the black flag of ISIS, which will enslave you and rape you if you're a Yazidi woman, which will expel you or kill you if you're a Christian, which will enforce its form of Islam on you if you're a Sunni, even if you don't agree with their particular form of Islam. And these ISIS and the other jihadis have received vast support from Western intelligence sources, including training in Southeast Turkey, going back to 2012. And on the other side, Russia and Iran have propped up the regime. The war has been allowed to escalate because so many arms have been provided by both sides. You have to remember, Syria does not manufacture weapons. It has to buy them from abroad, and this goes for both sides. If there had been an embargo on weapons to Syria, perhaps the war could have been negotiated in its first year, but that was not the case. Everyone was fueling the fires on both sides.
We have been supportive of Turkey. We have been supportive of Qatar and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, and yet we do not criticize any of these regimes for their treatment of women, for their intolerance of other religions, especially Saudi Arabia, and for the fact that they have been exporting weapons training and massive amounts of money into people and groups that clearly are not interested in liberating Syria for Syrians and having anything representative of a peaceful way of living. And why isn't the media covering this? Why has there been such a limitation of calling out Saudi Arabia for beheading so many people, beheading and crucifying them?
Well, I think there are two problems here. One is the fact of what's happening. And Saudi Arabia, in particular, has been, and this goes back to the Cold War, has been funding mosques around the world, teaching a Wahhabi ideology, a Wahhabi Sunni form of Islam, an ideology that is very hostile to plurality and even to tolerance of divergent points of view. Now look at a small Muslim country like the Maldives Islands, where only a few hundred thousand people live, and where 30 years ago there were maybe half a dozen mosques. Now there are over 200 mosques funded by Saudi Arabia, and as a result, the Maldives Islands, which are in the middle of the Indian Ocean, about as far from Syria as you can imagine, have sent more young men per capita than any other country to go and fight in Syria for the jihadi forces. The same is true in Kosovo. There was a piece in the New York Times recently about Saudi funding of mosques in Kosovo and how many young men have gone from Kosovo, which was theoretically aided by NATO to achieve its independence. The fact that Saudi Arabia has been able to do this goes way back when the United States encouraged it to do this, and that goes to the 1950s when the United States saw Islam, conservative religious Islam, as a counterbalance to communism and socialism, which they were able to brand as atheists and thus repugnant to most Muslims. And they encouraged the Saudis to engage in a propaganda war against the left of all kinds throughout the Muslim world. And this grew and grew and came to fruition with all of the volunteers who came out of those Saudi-funded mosques to fight the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. No one has told the Saudis, no one in Washington has told the Saudis that this policy has outlived its usefulness and that it has actually become counterproductive. You would have thought, after the events of 9/11, that there might have been some consideration of this, but clearly there hasn't been, because the program has continued to grow since 9/11. Now, and the other issue is the media coverage. Some media coverage has been excellent. If you read Patrick Coburn in The Independent of London, if you read antiwar.com, if you read The Intercept, if you follow the WikiLeaks revelations, and some individual pieces in the New York Times have all been first class on this issue. But a lot of it has been not so good, often by people who have never been to Syria and don't know what they're talking about, often by people who have a Washington-centric view, and the consensus in Washington has been what Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama said it was at the very beginning of the demonstrations in Syria, was that Assad must go. And they thought that Assad would had a weak enough regime and was unpopular enough that he would go as quickly as Gaddafi went. But that was not the case, because, as I said earlier, his father had put in place a regime which was rock solid, in addition to which, not only did it have a repressive apparatus, it also had a degree of popularity in the major cities, certainly among minorities, but also amongst the Sunni business class, who were doing very well out of the Assad years.
Could you clear up the confusion in most people's minds that we believe in, as a country, not individually, but as a country, we believe, and the media has supported, that ISIS emerged of its own volition, that America had nothing to do with it, was not responsible. At the same time, Vice President Biden has suggested that the military model used to oust Gaddafi would be successful in Syria. As you just mentioned, it wasn't. And so Biden has suggested, along with people very adamantly, so even taking pictures of people who were in al-Nusra, is a senator from Arizona, John McCain, and who wants to support the rebels. And now the president said, we're supporting the moderates. And no one knows who's moderate. And ISIS ends up benefiting from this, because whoever wins in any battle or overruns another group or wants to work with another group becomes associated with it. So there's no clear demarcation between all these groups, and there's just over a dozen groups. And now we have Hillary Clinton's role to enabling the fighting to continue, even while the UN was trying to negotiate a ceasefire. And we are in the business of rapid regime change, as if we have a right to create these debacles, CIA and Pentagon sponsored, because we don't like a particular regime for whatever reason. Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Iran and Syria. And I don't believe the American public knows the truth. Could you enlighten us on these points, please?
One of the problems with Syria is that the United States intervention was covert, mainly in southeast Turkey, training rebels to go in and fight the Assad regime. And just as with the jihadis that were trained in Pakistan to go and fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan, they weren't looking too closely at the people they were training and arming. Inevitably, the people who were going to fight with the greatest dedication and their greatest fanaticism would be those who believed that they could die for God. And those people ended up in ISIS or in Jabhat al-Nusra and similar groups. By the way, there aren't just several groups. There are Jane's Defense Weekly, at one stage in this war, counted over 1,500 groups. And this could be a group giving itself a grandiose name, but would be just a local warlord in a village with maybe 25 young men. But those weapons are still coming across the border from Turkey to supply him if he toes the line, and the line is the Saudi line, because that's where most of the money comes from. The United States looked as if early this year when John Kerry met Sergei Lavrov, and they made their statement in February, it realized after 5 years of trying to depose the regime and failing that the policy wasn't working, and therefore the parties had to go back to Geneva and negotiate a transitional period in which Assad would take part and at the end of which he would leave. However, the fighting, there was a ceasefire. The fighting did lessen significantly, improving the lives of people in many parts of Syria. But both the Russians and the United States did continue arming each side and allowing its surrogates to continue fighting on certain battlefronts. Which front was supposed to be excluded from the ceasefire, which front was meant to be included in the ceasefire, was not explicitly stated. So it seems that the Russians and the Americans have abandoned the policy of last February of negotiation and are willing to try for a military solution. But I would think that the events of the last 5 years would have shown that there is no military solution in Syria.
I think that's obvious now. But unfortunately, once we start, we don't know how to stop. We don't have that sense of irony or reflection. We just continue doing more of it. And it was so
much we do. Everyone knows how to stop. You stop you by telling, and this goes for the Russians as well, you tell the people you're arming and supporting that the war is over and they have to come to a compromise, and you dictate the terms of the compromise and end the fighting once and for all, which is what most Syrian people want. I mean, I don't think anybody is holding out hope for victory, any of the Syrian people themselves. When the United States talks about these moderate rebels, it reminds me of the Vietnam War, when for almost 20 years the U.S. kept talking about a third force in Vietnam that it was looking for or trying to create, which was not the corrupt regime of Saigon and was not the Viet Cong. It was some mythical force. Well, these moderates are really don't exist. I mean, there are a few hundred, maybe even a few thousand, who call themselves moderates. But on the battlefield, they are not a significant player. They are not the people who are fighting against the Assad regime and in the areas they control oppressing the Syrian people. Yeah, they're going to have to have a solution, a peaceful solution of all the parties that are not fanatic jihadists, and then allow the Syrian state to restore itself and that state, together with the Kurds in northeast Syria, throw ISIS out of the country.
Well said. Charles Glass, thank you very much for being on, and hopefully people will learn even more with your book, Syria Burning, A Short History of a Catastrophe. Website is charlesglass.net. From Paris, France. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you very much.
I'm Gary Knoll. Here's our question for TalkBack today. Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, so many of the individuals who uncovered corruption, uncovered wrongdoing, whether it was the National Security Agency employee that uncovered and was able to prove that we were illegally torturing and waterboarding, he went to prison for that. What is your thought? I believe that we should abolish all laws that are themselves based upon an injustice. If you have a law that says if you do something, your wrong will be punished, but what if that law is protecting people who are doing something wrong, who are not punished, ever? I've never seen any of the FBI agents in Operation COINTELPRO or MKUltra. I've not seen any of the CIA agents who were engaged in the Phoenix program that caused the death of tens of thousands. I've seen none of the people engaged in torture, including the psychologists, held accountable. And yet the people that report on it are, under the most draconian Espionage Act 1917 laws. I believe that these should be abolished. I believe that the National Defense Authorization Act should be abolished, the Patriot Act abolished. I believe that the 16 intelligence agencies be closed down. That's my view. I want your view. Because otherwise, who's going to come forward and tell us what's being done wrong if the punishment for doing so is so severe? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And while you're thinking about that, let's listen to Robert Reich talk about the right to work laws.
In a number of states, a battle is being waged over so-called right-to-work laws, which should really be called right-to-work-is-wrong laws because they're so bad for workers. Right-to-work sounds harmless, but it's not. Consider these facts. The average worker in states with right-to-work laws makes 12.2% less annually than workers in states without right-to-work laws when all other factors are removed. People in right-to-work states are less likely to have health insurance and pay more out-of-pocket for insurance. Right-to-work states have higher poverty, higher infant mortality, less investment in education, and higher workplace fatalities. So why do right-to-work laws hurt workers in all these ways? Because these laws destroy unions. That's their purpose. Here's how. Under the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, when a majority of workers votes for a union in their workplace, they're entitled to have a union. And that union bargains with management for higher wages and better working conditions. The union has bargaining clout because all workers at that company are union members. That's what union means. Right to work takes away the rights of workers in a union to collect dues from everyone in the bargaining unit who benefits from the bargains. This eventually eliminates the resources the union needs to bargain for higher wages and put pressure on employers. When unions are able to get higher wages and better working conditions, this raises the bar for all workers. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the corporate-backed American Legislative Exchange Council are pushing these right-to-work laws because they claim they care about workers. But who are they trying to fool? The Chamber of Commerce and ALEC don't care about workers. They represent corporations. The truth is, their corporate sponsors don't want American workers to have the bargaining power they need to get higher wages and better hours and working conditions. The Chamber and ALEC say right-to-work states attract more businesses. The truth is, they attract businesses that seek lower wages, businesses that don't invest in their workers, don't do research and development, don't add value, and therefore are the most likely to go abroad for even cheaper labor at the slightest provocation. It's bad enough American wages have been stuck in the mud for three decades while corporate profits have soared and top executive pay has gone through the stratosphere, and that almost all the economic gains have been going to the top 1%. So-called right-to-work laws are part of this problem and are making all this even worse. The only way average Americans are going to get a fair share of the gains is if they have more bargaining power, as they did 50 years ago when a third of all workers in the private sector were unionized. Now, fewer than 7% are. We have to increase, not reduce, the bargaining power of average people. So don't be fooled by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Legislative Exchange Council. They want to lower your wages so big shareholders and top executives can rake in even more. Don't let them. Join the fight against so-called right-to-work laws and let them know right-to-work is wrong.
Charles from New Jersey. Hi, Charles, your turn.
Hey, Gary, thanks so much for everything you do. I completely 100% agree with you that everything that, boils over after the fact that we get years and years down the line, nobody gets in trouble. And just like you had the interview with the whistleblower yesterday and Danny Sheehan, the attorney, who I'm sure is hopefully taking care of himself, because, having that much evidence and being a target, because those kinds of people are always assassinated because they don't want the truth to be with any proof, with any legs. So I hope we get, the only way is for us to use word of mouth and spread the word while the internet is still available, because the government is now trying to censor it, and Facebook and everybody is meeting with all these Nazi German and Chinese communist parties, and the system is pretty much ready to be shut down.
It's being challenged, certainly. Charles, I agree. We need to hear more from Danny Sheehan. This coming Friday, I'm having Danny back for a full hour to talk about which corporations are owned by the wealth masters. Who are they? Name the corporations so we can decide whether we want to boycott them or not. How do they run America? What have been their coups that the public is not aware of? Who have been the people who have been at the forefront of their evil empire? Thank you, Charles. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening.